Before I get started today, I wanted to make sure that I gave a big shout out to Jeannie Coleman Coaching. Jeannie is a stress and mind-body coach based in Los Angeles. She spent over 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and many other TMS symptoms that left her physically and mentally depleted. After healing herself completely, Jeannie is now obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. And the coaching program includes weekly support, consistency, and accountability. Basically, you've got Jeannie in your back pocket, helping you along the way. Perhaps you've done years of therapy, or perhaps you've been working on your childhood or your past traumas, and now you want a different approach. It's time for action and a results-driven approach instead, and one that specifically focuses on TMS and mind-body healing. Working with Jeannie in itself lowers stress because she'll take the overwhelm out of the mountain of TMS info and customize it into a simple game plan that works best for you and your current lifestyle. Jeannie is great. She's one of very few in-person interviews, actually, that I've done on this podcast. And she definitely has a vibe of she's been your friend for years, or even better, in my opinion, somebody maybe that you disconnected with over the years, you can bump into at a bar and just have a great conversation and question with. She has a really good energy about her in that way. I understand that it can be scary to reach out for support. I've known Jeannie for years, and her clients are receiving much more than reducing just their TMS symptoms. She's a coach dedicated to thriving in all areas of your life, not just your health. She's truly a coach. You need to go to her website, jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieKulwin.com, to book your free 45-minute call. And I will tell you that in the coaching world, whether it's TMS coaching or any kind of coaching, to get a 45-minute introductory call to really see if there's a bond and a connection there is not common. So go and check it out. Creeping right along in the month of May, it is Thursday, May the 25th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast if you're interested in supporting this show. It is on the air for free for many, but it's because of the support of people like Jeannie Coleman and people who are making regular contributions to the show. That would be Teresa and Lauren, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Daniel, Kirk, Emily, Elise, Enda, Dominic, John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Mike, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast week after week, month after month, and for many of you, year after year, going back to years before the pandemic began, which is really amazing. So thank you for being here. This week, part two of my conversation with Dr. Jeff Axelbank, and we talk a lot about kind of his methodology. And I called it the three pillars, or maybe I stole that from him, the three pillars. But we're going to wrap up this interview. So this will be about 30 or 35 minutes, getting the back half of this. So I really think you're going to enjoy it. Dr. Axelbank was great to chat with, and there's a lot of really cool content that's coming up over the next couple of months here on the show. So without further ado, let's listen to the back half of Jeff, Dr. Axelbank, and me. You had mentioned earlier, like way back when we were talking about the doctor that sent you for the C-spine MRI and that you had been practicing for a long time. So this experience or that experience for you, did you then, shifted a lot of your practice into more of a mind-body syndrome TMS type thing? How did you get into start helping clients with that?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. And I think partly what it is that I already had patients who were dealing with it. I just hadn't really paid much attention to it. So, you know, with the patients I was already seeing, there was some new ground to kind of, you know, open up. But then I had this interesting experience where a colleague I had presented about SARNO and about this approach to a local psychological association colleagues. And one of them contacted me and asked me if I would be her therapist. And I felt I knew her too well, and I didn't want to do that. So I said, well, you know, I won't do it, but let me see if I can find somebody. And that led me to, say, the TMS Wiki, where there's a provider directory, and I got connected to a whole community of therapists already doing this work, including many of the people who you've probably had on your show, Howard Schubiner and all. And I also learned that there were two physicians right in my area who had been trained by Sarno. And so I met with them and had introductions and had us sort of starting to trade referrals back and forth. And just, I think, over time, more and more, I just started getting those referrals. Also, people, my colleagues knew that I was doing this work from the presentations. And so it sort of evolved. It wasn't like, all of a sudden, it just slowly but surely more and more of my practice became that. And as I said, even patients who come for other reasons often will have some mind-body thing going on.
Do you have any, like at this point in time in 2023, as you're working with patients, you know, you have 10 patients that you're working with at a time. What's the percentage of those that are coming in with a, you know, chronic pain being the major issue that they're trying to solve versus that's not really a part of the equation, meaning the reason that they're seeking you out at this point in time? Is it primarily aiding people with chronic pain symptoms, or is that less than half of who you're working with at any point in time?
Yeah, it's probably about half.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And also, I want to say one of the things that I really love about Sarno's books is that he really normalizes it. And I think, you know, in part, this is just, we all are dealing with this. It's part of the human condition. Sarno acknowledged, you know, his own struggles with migraines. And it's sort of like there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just part of being human. And so even people who don't, as I said, people who don't come for that, often it just emerges as we're talking. And then people who do come for that, there's often, you know, other things. Once, you know, as I said, if the pain is the way to distract from things that you really, have been avoiding or not facing, then once you deal with the pain, then you've got other things to work on. And so even if someone came to me initially because of some pain thing, often we end up working on lots of other things, their marriage or their relationship with their family or work issues or something else that may have been sort of the underlying cause of the pain.
I'm curious to know, one thing that Sarno talked about in his books, and since you're actively practicing, I'd be curious as like the evolution of symptoms almost, that he talked about like carpal tunnel being a thing that was in vogue. And he also talked about ulcers being a thing that was in vogue, meaning that, you know, now he sees this sleuth of this large collection of patients that have this type of issue, and that it seems like it was evolving almost like by the decade that something became popular. Yeah. What have you seen in the last, let's call it 5 to 7 years, has been kind of up and comings, maybe not the right word, but maybe that is the right word.
I mean, well, yeah, what's the, I don't know if you want to call it in fashion, because that sounds like almost a positive thing.
But, yeah.
But I think there is a contagion, you know, aspect. Maybe that's the right term. I've seen people with sciatica is something that I've seen, and also GI symptoms, irritable bowel syndrome. I guess that's kind of, those are the ones that stand out to me, but it's still, you know, people, neck pain, back pain. And I see a lot of people who have been through a bunch of different surgeries, and the surgery hasn't solved their pain. And so that, I think, you know, the the incidence of spinal surgery has just gone way up, and yet it's not solving the pain problem.
Dr. Hanscom, I'm sure that you either know him or have heard of him. I've had him on a couple of times, and I mean that's kind of why he got away from practice. Like actually, the first time that I met him, we did an in person because I think now he's in the Bay Area, but he was in Seattle the first time that I met him, and we met down at the Washington Athletic Club, which is kind of this. I mean, I guess I would just call it like a bougie athletic club kind of thing, almost like a country club, but there's also, you know, there's fitness and all sorts of stuff that's there. And I met him there, and he had like a limp. And one thing that he talked about was like, you know, for years he would have these, how I would describe after meeting him is that his top, and maybe we'll chat a little bit about this too, just in general, but sort of his top symptoms seemed like it was more anxiety, panic attacks. He had described this event of having a massive anxiety attack on one of our toll bridges that we have here that crosses from the west side of the east side or the east side of the west side. He had a limp, and he was talking about how he doesn't have pain. And he explained a lot of it behind that, how, you know, years ago, this limp that he has in his knee would be pain. But he was talking about how there's this incredible dissociation. And he was talking about all this research that has come out over the last number of years involving that pain and what's on imaging and things like that is not all correlated. He stopped doing back surgeries entirely. I think after seeing enough research that fell into that.
Yeah. And that makes me think of another thing that maybe is sort of in vogue or contagious is OCD symptoms. And that can be in terms of behavioral rituals. I mean, the classic is, of course, you know, hand washing, but it can also be obsessive thoughts, thoughts or intrusive images that keep coming to people. And I have tended to treat that in a similar kind of way that I would a TMS or a physical symptom, in that, like, you know, often if it's pain, I will say to someone, you know, if we weren't talking about your pain now, what would we be talking about? Like what else is going on in your life? And similarly, you know, if someone has some obsessive worry about germs or about sexuality or you know, there's all kinds of different things that people obsess over and just cannot get out of their minds. Well, if you weren't thinking about that, what would you be thinking about? And often if you can get them to talk about those other things, then the obsessions, the obsessive thoughts kind of go away or at least get diminished. And in my mind, this is something that happens, I think, a lot with younger people, whether it's, you know, OCD type of stuff or chronic pain, GI symptoms, is separation issues. And so, you know, Sarno talked a lot about, you know, anger, but I think also conflict, things that you have inner conflict about. And so someone who's like in their 20s, let's say, or even, you know, late teens, a lot of people have conflict about separating and getting on with their lives. And that may be because of their own anxiety about being on their own. Yeah. It may be also because their parents are kind of clinging on to them and not really encouraging them. And so sometimes it's easier to just have a pain to focus on rather than have to deal with that very difficult and kind of normal phase kind of thing about, well, how am I going to launch myself? So that's something that I've seen quite a bit.
The quote, I wrote this down because it kind of brought to mind something that I've talked about on this show before, but if we weren't talking about the pain in your life, what else would we be talking about? And I oftentimes think that, and this is sort of, I'm half smiling as I say this, but family get-togethers, pre-pandemic, you know, they happened all the time and they're starting to happen all the time again. But one thing that I would notice in a lot of these get-togethers as a family is that everybody's sort of, you know, standing around in a circle. I envisioned this one to this Father's Day weekend or something. It was some summer event because we were outside. But everybody's standing in a circle talking about their various aches and pains, and that's how everyone's connecting. And pre-Sarno, I would be in that circle, and I'd be sharing about whatever ache and pain I have. But post, I can't bring myself to stand in that circle or talk about it or even in a lot of ways listen to it, which kind of sounds awful. But that's what that quote makes me think of is, if we weren't talking about the pain in your life, what else would we be talking about? Do you have any commentary on, like, you know, people do feel this sense of connection when they can all talk about their ankle pain or their hip pain or their knee or their back or the thing that's bothering them physically. Do you have any commentary on it? Because it's tough for people to think about standing around and talking about their emotional problems, right?
Well, yeah, especially if their emotional problems are about the family.
Yeah, so, good point.
I'm imagining, you know, the alternative is family therapy, you know,
yep.
where you're sitting around and saying, "Mom, I really always hated when you did X, Y, Z," or "My brother, why did you always beat up on me when I was a little kid?" Or, you know, it's just much easier to say, "Geez, I can't, you know, I have this sciatica problem."
Yep.
But it also reminds me of another sort of common thing that happens when people call. You know, some people have been dealing with their pain, you know, they're managing, and then they'll call and they'll say, "You know, I'm scheduled to go on a cruise, or I'm scheduled to go on a trip, and I really want to be able to, like, enjoy it. I want to be able to hike, or I want to be able to be on the cruise and be okay. And so, you know, I'm going on this cruise in 2 months. Can you, you know, help me?" You know, and my first question is always, "Well, how do you feel about spending time with these people that you're going to be going on vacation with?" Because that's, you know, if you're afraid that you're going to be in pain on this vacation, maybe we need to talk about what you're anticipating the vacation is going to be like.
Yeah.
And that has often led to, you know, surfacing issues in a marriage, you know, that, you know, when you're on vacation with your spouse, or your partner, or your family, for that matter, you know, your parents, that really tends to surface all the longstanding dynamics, patterns, things that you've sort of been submerging. And so in my experience, when we surface those, first of all, it makes the pain go away. And second of all, it may provide a opportunity to do some work, some marital work. Maybe there are some things that need to be worked on in the marriage that would be very helpful.
Do you tend to see, because this kind of goes back to that separate, like we talked about earlier, where it's not necessarily the things that are current are causing the problem, but they might be, I forgot the term that you use, but they're almost bringing you back, like, to something that happened earlier.
Like an echo of, or a resonance.
Yeah, the echo. That's what I was thinking of. when you talk about, like, marital issues, for instance, if you're starting to uncover that, what sort of link could a marital problem, and you can literally just pick any out of a hat because everybody's are kind of a little bit different, but are there certain callbacks or themes that they become a marital problem? You start discussing that with a patient and it gets a callback to something that maybe would have happened 20 or 30 years ago. Like, are there any examples that maybe you could give?
Well, I'm almost feeling like it's like every single case is an example, because basically, I mean, let's face it, we marry one of our parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
and in the ideal, I think we marry someone who's enough like our parent to be attractive, but also enough different that it allows us to work something through that was, you know, needs to be worked through about our parents. So, for instance, if, you know, if your parent was very controlling, and then you marry someone who's also kind of controlling, but hopefully they're not quite as controlling as your parent, and they can take some feedback, and they can maybe, lay off a little bit, and then you actually can actually heal something. But I think it's almost universal. You either marry someone who's just like your parents, or totally the opposite. But either way, it brings up all kinds of issues, and the hopeful thing is that it's an opportunity to work something through. The times where it gets really, you know, sort of more difficult is when the person really is a lot like your parent. And I think the classic example is, you know, abusiveness. That, you know, you had an abusive parent, and you marry a partner who's also abusive, and then, you know, there's sometimes, you know, sometimes it's workable, but sometimes it is, you know, something that you have to think, maybe I want to get out of this. So, but that's obviously an individual situation and choice.
Do you find, and this is more of like a selfish question, what you're saying is making, it's something that's making me think, like my parents, for instance, when I was a kid, like money was always a conversation. It was always on the table, scarcity around money. We don't, you know, we're broke. We don't have this, whatever. And as an adult, outside of my first couple of years of, well, outside of college and my first couple of years after college, like I've done okay for myself and I don't really have a scarcity around money, or I don't have to have a scarcity around money. Let me put it that way. Like there's no real reason for me to have that. But at the same time, I very much have an attitude as if like I always tell my boss, it doesn't matter how much money I make, I will always feel broke. And that right. is a throwback to childhood, I think. And that sounds pretty similar to what you're talking about too.
Yeah. And I think there's some, societal, evidence of that too. I mean, people, the generation that grew up in the Depression, often, you know, would be penny pinching, even though they had plenty of money, because they always, you know, were just, that's how they grew up, with nothing. It actually reminds me of my grandmother, who came from Eastern Europe and Russia, Tsarist Russia, and was really afraid of the landlord. Didn't really want to, was always afraid to, you know, let the landlord know there was a leak or something like that. And it turned out that she sort of felt like the landlord was like the czar.
Wow.
And
yeah.
and would act like the czar. And so, you know, it took a while for, you know, first of all, you know, this is America and the landlord has a responsibility, and they do actually come and fix the leak when you let them know, you know.
They're not going to come and pound you with a hammer or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Or take you prisoner yeah. or something. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's kind of universal. You know, we're all kind of prisoners of, you know, what we grew up with. And of course, the challenge is working with that, and rather than taking it as, you know, as a given, that is the way the world is.
Totally feel free to not comment on what I'm about to ask, but you had talked about social contagion. I wrote next to it. You'd said social contagion, GI, OCD symptoms, behavioral issues, those kind of things. One that, I've kind of had this phrase in my head over the last couple of months, because something my wife and I have talked about, meaning that she's brought it up and just talking about people that we know or whatever. But when I was in high school and when I was in college, more so in high school, ADD became this sudden thing. And there were a lot of kids that got put on Ritalin, and that was sort of the thing in the early and mid-2000s and late 90s. I feel like that was around a lot. And then there was this period of time where I heard nothing really about it with people that I knew, and maybe it was just less of a thing in college or in my business relationships or whatever. But now I almost feel like I hear that it almost seems like every other person has ADHD. And I'm wondering if is a part of that a social, because I know in high school, for instance, I would have friends that like they wanted to get a hold of Ritalin more so for the recreational drug use of what they wanted to do with it. And it was very easy, at least at that time, to go into a doctor and purposely fail an ADD test or whatever they would do to administer, and they could get a Ritalin prescription and they could get a lot of it. And now I feel like there's a lot of either people that I know that are being diagnosed with ADHD, or like, do you have any comment about that? And it's okay if you don't, but it's something that's been bumping around in my head for the last few months is I feel like I see or hear that term a lot, like a lot more than I did 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I'll answer, but with a caveat that I don't know everything.
Yeah. So, neither do so I. I got you.
I'll just tell you what I think. I think symptoms of ADHD can be caused by a lot of things. It can be caused by anxiety, can be caused by depression, can be caused by psychosis. So you really have to get under the symptoms and see what's causing it. Just like, you know, just like if you have pain, it can be caused by a fractured bone, or it can also be caused by a mind-body thing. You really need to understand what it is, or if you have a fever, it could be caused by a virus or by, you know, a bacteria. I'm not sure what to make of the, you know, the epidemic, as you're kind of calling it, of ADHD, because it could be the symptoms are, you know, our epidemic, but the cause may be different causes. But I also want to throw out a kind of, this is going to be interesting, I think, because when I first heard it, it was really jarring. I have a colleague who believes that ADHD, attention deficit disorder, is an attention deficit from childhood. In other words, you received a deficit of attention. You didn't get enough attention, and that's why you have ADD.
Wow.
And that's really an interesting idea, that people act out or they have symptoms of ADD because they didn't get enough attention as a kid, and therefore they can't pay attention now.
Yeah, and I'm just rattling through the people that I'm thinking of that, again, have gotten this diagnosis in the last 6 months or a year that I know, and kind of makes sense.
Well, think about it. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure that I would question, and I don't have enough experience with this myself, I would question how that sort of understanding would lead to differences in treatment. And I think where it would lead to is, first of all, not necessarily medication, but where it would lead is for the therapist to really pay a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And to kind of heal that and to maybe get closer to what that was like growing up with, I guess it's sort of like emotional neglect, and getting closer to what that is like may help the person overcome that that other understanding or meaning of attention deficit, you know.
It's interesting. So there's lots of people listening to this probably that have had, you know, they're aware of these concepts. They make sense to them. They've read the books. They've heard podcast episodes, things like that. Yet they're still sort of stuck in the symptoms that they're having, and they don't seem to be able to make progress. In your experience and working in this line of work and in this discipline for a while, are there maybe a couple of things that you have seen as a pattern, or maybe certain things that are holding people back from being able to get better? Like if you had to, you know, you're taking somebody that maybe they come to you and they say, Jeff or Dr. Axelbank, I've been journaling for such and such years. I'm aware of these concepts. I still have back pain. Like, are there certain blockades that you tend to find in people? Like what are maybe some of those, if you have a couple of examples?
Yeah, I think the main one that comes to mind that I've seen is that people not fully believing that it's not a physical problem. Like they have 2% that still wonders, maybe it really is bone on bone rubbing, or my nerves being impinged on by a ruptured disc, or I do really have carpal tunnel, or the sciatica, you know, there's something really wrong. And even if, you know, the preponderance of their feeling is, yeah, it's probably mind body, there's still this kind of, there is a doubt. And I guess in my experience, if you really don't throw yourself whole hog, I think I saw a recording of Sarno saying you have to jump in with both feet.
Yeah.
And you can't be kind of hanging on to the edge of the pool. You really have to kind of jump in. And it's terrifying, really, you know, because you're afraid that you're going to be in excruciating pain, or you're going to make the pain worse. I don't know if you've had Alan
Gordon
on.
He's sort of like one of the last Infinity Stones of the people who've like put out a book or talked about this stuff. Right. I haven't. Well, I've emailed him with him, but I haven't been able to talk to him.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly encourage it. His book, The Way Out, is a great book, and he really focuses on the fear pain cycle, or fear pain fear pain pain fear cycle.
Yeah.
That. So I think part of, you know, that obstacle, that thing that just sort of keeps people in the same place is the fear. And that fear ends up perpetuating the pain. And really the way to overcome that is to be able to really jump in with both feet. And even just beginning a little at a time, people who have said, you know, I just can't walk. And I say, well, just like even just walk around your apartment. And Alan Gordon's book, The Way Out, talks about somatic tracking. And while you're doing that, just notice how it feels. You don't have to make the pain go away. Just sort of notice it, but keep on moving. And people generally find that the pain does go away, even though they're afraid that it won't.
God, I wish I would have written this down. Let me see if it comes to me. It was a really good question too. It was about something you were talking about 2 minutes ago, and now it's not coming to me.
Well, let me just riff a little bit more on, you know, other obstacles, other things that sort of get in the way. This is sort of a weird one, but sometimes I have people come to me and, you know, they say that their pain is a result of, you know, a car accident 5 years ago, and they want to get rid of the pain, but they've also got this lawsuit happening.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a fall, a slip and fall lawsuit. And I have said to people, look, I think I can help you get rid of the pain, but it's going to ruin your lawsuit.
Yeah.
And so you have to make a decision. And it's kind of unbelievable, but most people opt for the lawsuit. And they say, well, I'll come back to you after the lawsuit. You know, after it's all finished. And I say, okay. But so far, I don't think a single one of those people have come back.
That was going to be my next question, is literally how many people come back? I'm a big, full transparency, I'm a big pro wrestling nerd. Like, that's kind of my thing since I was a little kid. Right. And I don't know if this company's even still around, but there was a term in the 90s where because Lloyd's of London policies were big in the 90s for athletes. And like a wrestler would, you know, they'd break their back or break their neck or whatever, and they could take this massive Lloyd's of London settlement, but it would mean that they couldn't ever wrestle again. And I always had the thought, like, since I've read the Sarno books, and then thinking, like, maybe they could have healed and recovered from that injury and got back to what they wanted to do. But what would happen with that? Like, Lloyd's of London would take back their $10 million or whatever it was that they had.
Exactly.
That's what it makes me think about. Yeah. Okay. The last two questions, and it did come to me, the one I was thinking about. So earlier you were talking about resuming normal activity as normal as possible and diving back in with both feet. I've had people that have asked me over the years in doing this show about, because one thing that I've talked about a lot is, like, I was a competitive weightlifter before the pain got too big to ignore, basically. And then when it got too big to ignore, I completely stopped training, and it was months and months and months of, it was surgery and it was doctors and it was procedures and it was all this and just nothing. And then read Sarno's book on a weekend at the end of June, and by the next Monday, I went to the gym and I haven't stopped since. And that was 6 years ago. So I did jump back in with both feet. But I do get the question a lot around graded exposure and people getting back into it slowly. My philosophy personally is, like, the only way to sort of reinforce to the brain that, hey, I'm okay, is to do everything that you can do. What's sort of your take on graded exposure versus diving back in with both feet?
I think it depends on the individual and managing their fear pain thing. Something I like, there's another metaphor that I like to use, because these pain pathways are kind of neural pathways that, you know, it's almost like, you know, habitual firing of neurons, neural pathways. And the only way to break the pathway is to form a new pathway and let it kind of, extinguish. And the metaphor that I like to use is, like, if you walk in the woods and you always walk on the same path, then that path is going to get tamped down and there's going to be a path there. And if you say, okay, I'm going to start walking on a different path, then you'll start tamping down a different path. And eventually that old path is going to get overgrown. It's going to, stuff is going to grow up there, and there's not going to be a path there anymore. And so I think it's a matter, that's what happens with neural pathways. The more you limit your activities in order to sort of avoid or manage the pain, the more you're going to have the pain, because you just keep reinforcing that same path. the only way to do it is to start to create a new path. And I think that, you know, that first time you're, you know, whacking through the bush to get to get a new path, that is hard work. But the next time you don't have to whack as many of the weeds away, and it starts to clear out. And so I think it's, you know, some people like to, you know, do maybe the first 3 feet of the pathway and then come back, and then maybe the next day they'll do 3 more feet. And some people like to go out with the machete and just sort of like whack their way through the whole, you know, the whole forest. And so I think it's kind of, as a therapist, I certainly encourage people to do, you know, Sarno's thing is resume normal activities as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And so I think it's kind of as soon as possible, like as soon as you can do it, do it.
Yeah.
And it's, that's kind of individual.
I want to wrap up with, you'd mentioned earlier, you run a consultation group for therapists who do this work. Talk a little bit about that for any therapists that are listening.
Yeah, well, I think I was motivated to do that mostly because I get more referrals than I can handle. And the need is just huge. And I just needed more people to refer to. And so I've given some presentations, webinars on this topic. And from that, I've gotten people who want to continue to do the work. And then I now have a, you know, a cadre of therapists I can refer to, at least locally.
Yeah.
you know, what's been great about that is that it also has allowed me to sort of, and all of us really in this group, to see some of the common underlying dynamics. Like, for instance, I mentioned before separation issues. As something that insight came from just hearing different therapists presenting different cases and seeing this common thread. So that's you know, been a really great experience. And many of these therapists have been through various different training. Howard Schubiner has some training on emotional awareness and expressive therapy. EAET, Alan Gordon's pain reprocessing therapy. And, you know, inevitably, not everyone responds to the kind of orthodox version of a particular therapy. So it's really nice to kind of mix and match and see which therapy a particular patient responds to. And so that's something that also has been nice in the group for people to see. There's different ways of working with different people and finding the you know, the particular combination that works for this particular patient.
Awesome. Well, hey, hang out on the line. We're going to do sort of this fake goodbye thing, but hang out on the line so I can hit stop on the recorder.
Sure.
It was such a treat. I honestly think that you're doing some of the most important work that there is possible. And I'm sure you're a humble guy, and so you don't have to say, okay, you know, I appreciate your compliment and everything, but truly, I think you're doing amazing work, and I really appreciate you being here. Do you have a website where people can go and learn more about you that are across the country? Do you work with people that aren't local to Jersey?
I do not.
Okay. So if you're in New Jersey, give him a shout. But certainly check out his website, which looks like it's, Jeffrey, I'll link this in the show notes, but Jeffrey Axelbank, PSYD.com.
That's right. And the PSYD is, you know, the degree, Doctor of Psychology, Psychology Doctor, PSYD. So it's Jeffrey Axelbank, PSYD.com.
Excellent. Thanks so much for being here. Hang on the line for a couple seconds, thanks again for being
and
here.
And thank you for having me. It's been fun to have this conversation, and loved the probing questions. It made me think.
Good. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you. All right. Hey, that was a real treat. It went an hour. It's a good thing we booked that little extra time on the calendar. So this will probably be a two-parter. I'll email you when it comes out so you have the link, but I'm thinking I'm probably going to have it air probably on the 10th and the 17th would be my guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Sweet. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, and it's been fun.
Yeah, great chatting with you. Thank you. Take care, Jeff.
All right.
All right, bye.
All right, take care. Bye, Eddie. Bye.